Oregon resident who's been out to see it on Agate Beach.
I hope nothing like this ever happens while we're still alive again. It's sad, you know, it's sad, but it's interesting. It's history right in front of us.
Cannon says it fascinates her to know something as large as a 165-ton dock from Japan could wash up in Oregon. An Oregon Parks official says that's just what happened. He says markings on the dock helped verify that it came from Japan. President Obama and the Democratic Party report raising a combined $60 million last month to support the president's re-election bid, considerably more than April. But challenger Mitt Romney has beaten the Obama effort with nearly $77 million raised last month. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Poetry Foundation, celebrating 100 years of Poetry Magazine, online at poetryfoundation.org.
More than a million families in America live in public housing, but cities nationwide are demolishing such homes in the name of community improvement.
I truly believe that additional housing needs to be in place before we can start knocking down buildings.
If I lose this, I have nowhere else.
Danville, Illinois, and the debate over public housing, a three-part series from CU Citizen Access and Illinois Public Media, next week on the Afternoon Magazine, right here on WILL AM 580.
Join us in September for WILL's Civil War Train. Board vintage train cars for stops in Vicksburg, Atlanta, Kennesaw Mountain, Chickamauga, and New Orleans. Visit the Smithsonian Southern and Southeast Railway Museums and see Civil War-era Washington, D.C. The trip is nearly sold out. Call 217-333-7300 or visit www.will.illinois.edu/willtravel for more information.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. Joan of Arc is probably the most recognized person in all of medieval history. Yet, historian Larissa Taylor says that few people know more than what they have seen in films. She says even fewer know that Joan was a real soldier and military leader. She was wounded several times in battle before her capture and execution at the age of 19. This morning, we will learn more about the teenage peasant girl behind the legend as we talk with Larissa Juliet Taylor about her recently published book, The Virgin Warrior, The Life and Death of Joan of Arc. The book is out now from the Yale University Press. If you'd like to read it, you can head down to the bookstore and take a look at it. Our guest is a professor of history at Colby College. She's joining us this morning by telephone. Professor Taylor, hello.
Good morning. Please call me Larissa.
Larissa, well, thanks very much for being with us. We
Thank
appreciate
you,
Dave.
It.
I think it's interesting here, just right up front in the acknowledgments for the book, you talk about the fact that you teach a course on Joan.
Yes.
And right on the first day, you ask the students to give them their initial impressions, what it is they come to the class knowing. And you write, they give predictable responses that she was anorexic, schizophrenic, or psychologically deluded. And then you go on to say that actually once they start to learn more about her, they change their ideas, they change their mind. But it sounds as if they probably, like most people, have this idea that she was either physically ill, mentally ill, or both, and that that those conditions really made her the person that she was.
Yeah, I think we have a tendency of modern people not to recognize the medieval mindset, and I think that's one of the largest hurdles I have to get over in teaching a course like this, because they can't understand that someone might believe in visions. And I do have some questions about whether Joan actually heard voices or had visions. But I think certainly in the medieval period, people did believe that it was possible. But for my students, that sounds very strange. They can't imagine divine inspiration as much as a medieval person could. Hearing voices sounds like something that would get them in the health infirmary pretty quickly. And also the fact that medieval saints did some strange things like fasting excessively and things like that. They don't understand that, and so they have to get past that and start reading some of the original documents and realizing the accomplishments that she actually did are quite astonishing and would have required a physical stamina that would certainly preclude a lot of things like schizophrenia and hallucinations.
Well, the thing that people will stay with, I'm sure. And she said herself that she was directed by God, and then she also went on to say that she had, that these saints had spoken to her. Mm-hmm. So that invites the question, was she saying what she believed? Was she saying something that would help to justify her cause, to say, look, I'm on a mission from God? Or, in a sense, could it be both?
I think it could be both. She definitely said that she heard a voice from God, and she told people at the time, not necessarily so much in her village, but as she was starting to go on her mission, she said she heard a voice from God, and others said that she had told them that. It was only at her trial by the English 2 years after she started that she was questioned by them and asked, did she hear a voice from God or angels or whoever? And she stuck to her guns about, I heard a voice from God, for the first four trial sessions. And it was only in fourth session that she said, I heard the voice of St. Catherine and St. Margaret and St. Michael. And that had always bothered me because her choice of saints is very convenient. Two were virgin martyr saints. One was the patron saint of France. One was a patron saint of prisoners. Another was very, very eloquent Catherine of Alexandria. And so it struck me that, especially since she told her trial judges that she intended to lie to them from the start of the trial, that she was kind of making some of it up as she was going along. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think is interesting and perhaps sets her apart from other people of her time is that actually we know a good deal about her. At least there is a substantial record both from her trial and then from the later overturning of that verdict.
Yes.
Although I suppose also you would have to take into account that initially she was telling the story that she wanted to tell, and that later when she was exonerated, people were telling the stories that they wanted to tell. So I suppose you have to take that into account.
Precisely. It's stunning for any medieval figure. I cannot think of a one for whom there are so many different kinds of sources from different sides. We have her own words at trial, but again, you've got to take it with a little bit of a grain of salt because of what she says at the beginning and sort through the genuine answers from ones she might be playing with. But that's from the English side along with her French collaborators. Then 25 years later, when that trial is overturned, it definitely was as political as the first trial was. But instead of just focusing on the political nature, which was to make sure that the King Charles had not been crowned by a heretic, what they did is they interviewed over 100 people, and these were villagers from Domremy, where Joan grew up. They were military comrades and soldiers. They were ordinary men and women walking the streets of Orléans or other places who had come into contact with Joan during her lifetime. And so these people, on the whole, had no axe to grind, or in most cases didn't. We also have chronicles and letters from all over Europe because it was a European phenomenon when she was doing the things she was in 1429. So they all have to be used very carefully. But I think when you look at it that way and you know you're reading it from some side or another and then put it all together and find the best source for each thing, I think it can work out.
I think just one other important point here I think that people should bear in mind about her trial is that while she was tried for heresy in an ecclesiastical court, and people perhaps see this as a religious trial or a religious event, this really was a political trial.
Absolutely. In fact, it's one of the points I try to make most strongly in the book. It's often just said the church burned Joan of Arc, and it was a church court that burned Joan. But at the same time, it was very much English-controlled. From even before the moment the trial started, John, Duke of Bedford, had told the main judge at the trial, Bishop Cauchon, that if he did not convict her, that they would take her back into English custody. And that would mean she would be taken to England, and I think we know the results of what that would be. Mm-hmm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Larissa Juliette Taylor. She's professor of history at Colby College and is the author of a new book about Joan of Arc. The title is The Virgin Warrior, and it's published by the Yale University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We should take a step back, I think, here and talk a little bit about the geopolitical facts on the ground in France at the time, when a lot of the country, a lot of the north, including Paris and a good piece of the west, was in the hands of the English. And if you include territory that was held by their French allies, it looks to me like that that might be as much as three quarters of France was not really controlled by the at least the French loyalists, the royalists who supported the man who went on to become Charles, right? Yeah. Charles VII. So let's talk about that, and also I guess the fact that at this time that the French were fighting among themselves over who had the right to the throne, and there seemed to be a real possibility that the English could actually take control of the entire country.
In fact, I would say it was likely, because there was a French family feud, you might call it, with the Burgundian faction. There were several assassinations, and the Burgundians decided to ally themselves with the English. And the Burgundians were on the northeast border of France, or the French territory, what we think of as France. The English, under King Henry V, good Prince Hal of Shakespeare fame, had won the Battle of Agincourt in 1415, and it was a dramatic victory. So many of the French the great nobles, soldiers, they were simply mown down. It was one of the great victories in history. And then after that, Henry V went on to conquer Rouen in Normandy. So he held a good bit of that area. And Orléans was the key, because England also held much of the southwest of France in Gascony and places like that. And Orléans in the Loire Valley was where the king had, or the Dauphin, as he was called, was stationed, because he really didn't have many followers at the time. He didn't have money to pay people. And so the English decided to besiege Orléans. And if it had fallen, the story might have been quite different.
Mm-hmm. What do we know about Joan and her life in the period, let us say, before her rise, certainly before she comes to the attention of the court?
Well, I had to reconstruct it from what villagers said about her in 1456. But even then, I think, while many of them said she was very pious, she went to church frequently, even she would leave, she would tell her parents she was going out into the fields, but she would go to church instead. She would go to on pilgrimages to a local monastery on Saturdays. And so there was definitely a piety that ran through her, but not over-the-top piety that was true of many medieval saints. She didn't play the usual games that most children in the region did. She apparently had to be dragged kicking and screaming to go dancing and singing with them. She would rather go to church and things like that. But at the same time, she showed herself to be very willful, even then. When the sacristan of the church didn't ring the bell for Vespers, she went down and reprimanded him for the fact. This is a young girl doing this. And she told him she would bake him little cakes if he then corrected his mistakes. She also seems to have gotten a little bit upset about the circumstances at home when she was probably about 15 or 16. The village was probably burned in 1425, and they took flight to a nearby village for a couple of weeks. But when they came back, whatever happened has been lost, unfortunately, because of 20th century events. But I've reconstructed as much as I can, and she seems to have started to do some strange things that attracted the notice of both her parents, her brothers, and some of the villagers who had, again, mocked her earlier for being a little bit too pious. But now she starts to go off and to visit her second cousin about 8 miles to the north, and lies to her parents sometimes to do so. And it seems that her parents set up a marriage alliance for her, probably with someone from the village. And meanwhile, Joan's going off on these little trips where she suddenly decides she needs to go see the king, and she's turned back at every stage. And her parents then try to get her home, try to get her married. She fights a marriage contract and wins it. And then she's finally allowed to go see the Duke of Lorraine and then sent to the king at Chinon. Mm. So it was getting pretty repressive in her household.
This would have been a time, and I think actually that it was maybe well into the 19th century, that there were a lot of people in France that didn't feel strongly that they were French, or that there was such a thing as French identity. So
right.
So certainly going back to this point, I would think that there were people who wouldn't have that kind of identification, and maybe there were people in France who wouldn't have cared particularly who the King of France was, whether the King of France was French or English. But it seems that perhaps on her part, there was that kind of sense, and that there was something that I guess I would call nationalism or nationalistic pride that she felt was worth fighting for.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think it goes back to the fact that she's she was born in a border region. Her town was actually partially in France and partially in Burgundian-held territories. But most of the people at the time had so many connections with both the Burgundian side, the English side, and the dynastic side with the royal family, that they were loyal to whoever could give them the most. And I think that was part of the reason France was having so many problems during the Hundred Years' War. But for Joan, she saw something that no one else seems to have seen. And I think perhaps in an odd way, because she was a young teenage girl from the peasant classes, she didn't have that baggage with her that so many others have. But we have her dictated letters, and it comes across very strongly that she wants to, as she says, boot the English out of all of France, and that if they don't get out of their own, she will do so. And so she's got a concept of Frenchness that comes through in her words and what she says at trial and in these letters. And I think she managed to communicate that to some of the military leaders, though, again, after her death, there was fragmentation once again. But for the ordinary men and women whose paths she encountered, they seemed to have flocked to her standard once she started talking about a France. And whether her king got it or not is not quite clear. But I think for her it was something that was becoming a reality. And she didn't create it, but she certainly, I think, set the stage.
Mm. All right. Let's talk with, we were going to talk with someone who was a caller. I will, again, invite callers if that person wants to call back. My apologies for making them wait. Or other folks who want to join the conversation, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And again, our guest for the program this morning is Larissa Taylor. She's professor of history at Colby College and is the author of the new book, The Virgin Warrior, The Life and Death of Joan of Arc. What's interesting here is that you talked about the fact that Joan herself seems to have been filled with this sense of mission and says that she goes off on this attempt to try to see the king or the would-be king.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there apparently had been for some time sort of rumors or stories or legends circulating about the fact that a virgin warrior would come to save France.
Yes.
And this was at a time when things are not looking good at all. And for, as far as the people around the man who would become Charles VII, they perhaps thought, well, you know, they were at their last, making their last stand. So it seems that perhaps that some of the people in his circle, his mother-in-law in particular, mm-hmm. were involved in boosting Joan. So you wonder, did they, whatever she was and whatever they saw in her when they finally saw her, did they think, here, we can use her, we can make use of her, and maybe, just maybe, that people would rally to our cause if she was holding the flag and standing at the front?
Yes, I definitely think so. As you mentioned, there had been several prophecies, but there had been many female prophets at the end of the 14th and early 15th century who were talking about the Hundred Years' War. They weren't being these very mystical visions. It was actually about concrete conditions in France. So Joan would have come out of that tradition, at least according to many. And I think the king's mother-in-law was definitely involved. She held territories in the area around where Joan was born. Her son, René of Anjou, also was in that area, and he did meet with Joan at one point after she met with the Duke of Lorraine. And the only way I can possibly explain what happened is if the king's mother-in-law got her the entree to the court. Because after Joan passed several tests, when she finally arrived at Chinon, it still seems to me that they had to do things to make this work. Who's going to believe or be afraid of a 17-year-old peasant girl? And in fact, the English weren't in the beginning, and they ended up terrified at her. So the court actually set about not only using the prophecies that were already and the legends that were already out there, but they created new ones that specifically fit Joan. And these were circulated as, I believe, she was being trained at the same time. Mm. I don't think they had any clue at all what they were unleashing.
Well, that's, I think, another interesting part of the story, because it seems that in part they started out to make something of her, and they did, and yet it seems that she got away from them.
Yes. Yes, she got away from them after Paris, the Battle of Paris. She had won several victories with her men, starting in Orléans in May of 1429, then several victories in June in the Loire Valley that made the Loire Valley safe for the French. They took it all back from the English at that point. And then there was quite a bit of discussion at the king's court. Should they then go on to Normandy and fight the English in their home place? And Joan insisted no. Charles had to be crowned as king, otherwise no one would really believe it. And I think she was actually very politically savvy in saying that, because that had been a long tradition in French kingship. But I think as time went on, this 17-year-old girl started to believe very much in the prophecies that had grown up around her. I don't think she was complicit in most of what was going on. But I think her pride and her conviction in herself and what she could do had been growing. She was seeing the adulation of people wherever she went. And so she insisted the king be crowned, and in fact it happened in mid-July. And then she wanted to go on and attack Paris, and that was a whole other story. Paris had two sets of walls around it, two moats, a very, very strong set of walls. And the Parisians, frankly, didn't want anything to do with politics. They just wanted to do their own business and not be bothered by the wars. So I think that was the turning point for her. She wanted to attack Paris. The king let her with a couple of her comrades, and it was a failure, and the king called it off. So things start to go downhill from September of 1429.
It seems remarkable, incredible, difficult to believe the idea that a young woman of her time did what she did, refusing the marriage that her parents wanted for her, becoming involved in politics. She had no formal education. She actually ended up wearing armor and going to war. It seems almost unthinkable.
It is. And it's something that I felt that when I first started teaching a course on the subject, the more I got to know Joan or felt I was learning about her, the less I understood her. And it was really only when I started to put together the idea, which has been circulating in French circles for some time, usually in popular magazines and things, the idea that the mother-in-law was involved, the king's mother-in-law, that if Joan had really been trained, as I contend, in the arts of war, because everyone remarked on how good she was, whether it was a woman whose house she was staying at in Orléans or her comrades in battle, everyone said she was like a captain who had been doing this for 30 years, and she was riding a horse. And there's a good chunk of time from February of 1429, when she arrives at the king's court, until the relief of the siege of Orléans in May, when there's nothing really accounted for. And so I believe they were secretly training her during that time, and obviously it would be in their best interest to keep that a secret. So I can't prove it, but it seems to make sense to me, because otherwise, how could she have learned the things she did?
Yeah. It's very tempting, and I think certainly a lot of modern feminists have been drawn to the character of Joan, and it's tempting to look at it the way we would now, to see her as a young woman, and to see that, say, particularly see the mother-in-law of Charles VII, and to put into their heads the idea that here they're living in a very patriarchal society where there wouldn't be that many opportunities for women to exercise power, and so that they would see here was their opportunity, and that they would take it, and that they would take great pride and satisfaction of knowing just how important they were. But that's looking at it
right
from our own perspective, and no doubt they would not have seen it that way at all, and there would indeed be some conflict in their minds, maybe, between what they were doing and what was seen as the appropriate role for a woman.
Surprisingly, I believe that they thought Joan was going to be a figurehead. And it was only once she got in the battlefield and in the discussions with other leaders that it became clear that she was not going to take a second seat to anyone. So I think that's what the king's party thought, that they were just creating something that would fit a legend. And I think Joan had other ideas. And I'm not even trying to view this in a feminist light, but as someone who, with the conviction of youth as a 17-year-old and just getting more so as time went on, I actually had the opportunity to speak with the actress Lily Sobieski, who played her at the same age in the CBS miniseries. And that was one of the things Lily had told me. She said she just felt that Joan had such a conviction, whether it was from God or whether it was in her own abilities and the things she had accomplished, that she could do this, and eventually that she felt she knew better than either the king or his mother-in-law or the courtiers who advised on a different course. So I think it's as much about her own convictions. But I do think there's a split in terms of the gender dynamic here. I think if you were on the English side, she was obviously a witch because she dared to wear men's clothing and do things like that, and she won battles. But on the French side, they had debated the issue of was it appropriate, for example, for her to wear men's clothing. And it made some people uncomfortable because there's a biblical prohibition against it in the Hebrew Scriptures. But finally, most of the French side said, no, this is appropriate because she's going to be fighting. She's going to be sleeping amongst men on the battlefield. So it really did depend on what side you were on. So I'm really not trying to push a feminist argument here. It's more that I believe it was her youth and her skills. She was a quick study at whatever she did.
This is, again, I think something for us, maybe it's a little bit difficult to understand now, the fact that one of the things that for her, the way people thought about her at the time for the trial, was indeed the fact that she wore men's clothes. And I think to us it would seem that why should you burn somebody for that?
Right.
But indeed that was a big issue.
It definitely was. And I think Joan herself made it more of an issue because after she was captured in 1430, she had pretty much been wearing fairly simple men's clothing from the beginning that the villagers had given her when she set off for Chinon. But then increasingly, after she won victories, she was sent rather sumptuous clothing that would befit a knight. And some of the chronicles of the time mention that at the time of her capture, she was actually pulled from her horse by some cloth of gold. And so very sumptuous clothing that would befit a knight. So that would not only be transgressing gender lines, but class lines as well, because she came from an upper class, well, it's a confusing thought for most modern people, from a well-to-do peasant family in the village, but still not someone who would be wearing finery of a knight.
Yeah.
And so I think that complicates matters even further, because I think that was an especial affront to the English. And so once she was in first Burgundian captivity and then handed over to the English, Joan absolutely refused to ever take off her male clothing. Even to hear Mass. She said regularly she begged them to hear Mass, to hear her confession. And they set conditions. They said, you know, if you will change into female clothing, we'll let you confess and hear Mass. And then Joan would then say right back to them, well, okay, I'll change into woman's clothing, but then I'll change back. And I think she, as again, a young girl, 19 by the time of her trial, she felt that those clothes that she had been wearing had allowed her to accomplish so many things that had been seemingly impossible, not only to her, but to so many in the French court.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Larissa Juliette Taylor. She's professor of history at Colby College and is the author of a newly published book that's titled The Virgin Warrior, The Life and Death of Joan of Arc, and it's published by the Yale University Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I'd like to have you tell the story of Orléans and the siege and what she accomplished, how she managed to accomplish to breaking the siege, because this was a very important turning point for her and also for the supporters of the Dauphin.
Yes, she had written a letter to the English while she was making her way toward Orléans, telling them that in God's name they better get out of Orléans, or that it was a wrong kind of thing. They never should have attacked the city or besieged the city because they held its duke in captivity. And she was right on that point. And eventually, since the English had no intention of leaving, but they were getting a little bit lax, she and the Bastard of Orléans, who was technically in control of Orléans, made their way, and they found the chink in the English armor in terms of the fortresses that were around the city. Southeast area, there was an opening. And the people of Orléans were very, very helpful, actually, in getting her in. They created some skirmishes. They knew she was coming, and they took heart from that. And so she was able to ride triumphantly into the city, even though the English are on the outside. And they probably realized, to their great dismay, what had happened after the fact. And so just the morale-changing aspect was huge in the beginning. And again, I don't think anyone at this point saw her as anything more than a figurehead. But they soon realized otherwise, because she wanted to be out in the fields, even according to some of the testimonies that suggest she wouldn't fight on one of the holy days. There's only one person who says that, and most contradict it. But within less than a week, Orléans had been taken, or had been secured from the English. The English were forced to retreat. Joan received an arrow wound, which I talk about at some length in the book, because some of the commentators who were with her say that it penetrated 6 inches, and then she was able to go pray and get back on her horse and fight again. And I argue basically that it was probably either a ruse or trickery, which she was known to agree to, or it might have been a flesh wound, but that they could make hay out of that, in a sense, by really giving a spirit back to the French soldiers, who, when they saw her wounded, would have been terrified that the cause was dead, or to the English, who saw her get up on her horse again and come at them. And in fact, again, when Les Tourelles was taken that day, that was the city, the place the English were holding, the English were probably just stunned beyond belief, because it did seem that this girl had walked into town, and less than a week she had done what others had not been able to do before her.
That does seem remarkable. How long had the English been laying siege to the city?
Since October of 1428. And one of their great leaders had been killed almost immediately after his arrival, which might be seen as an omen, I suppose. But they had a good presence there. I mean, they were scattered along the Loire Valley, but I think part of the problem was a lot of the French supporters were not really doing all that they could, and the Orléanais were left to their own devices to try and figure out what they could do to help, get some help. And so I think there was, again, measured determination about what they should do when they finally got there. There were certainly consultations among the major leaders, and Joan insisted on having her council as part of it. At one point, they started a battle without her, and that enraged her. So she got on her horse, she had the Lady of the House armor, and she went to the gates of the city and took part.
We have a caller here, someone up in the northern part of the state in Wilmette. So let's talk with them. Line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, I've got my question is, how English were the English at this point, realizing they were, you know, Normans? How acculturated, how changed were they from the French nobility? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Well, the English, actually, at the English court, they only started speaking English in 1399, at least on a regular basis. So that's a little bit before our time now. But I differentiate in the book between the true English who were coming from England to fight, such as the Duke of Bedford, the Earl of Warwick, and others, and Normans who were with them. There were certainly plenty of English who had settled in Normandy, and they probably spoke a kind of pidgin French or combined French-English. But I make a clear distinction between the people who were collaborating in Normandy with the English who held the territories, and that's, again, where Joan would be tried, and those who were truly English. And Normandy had been held since 1418 with a siege, or Normandy 1418, Rouen from 1419 with Henry V's conquest. So that area, again, had many people who were under English control. They may have been willingly so. Certainly the University of Paris was also under English control, and its theologians were the ones who had the most to do with condemning Joan to death. So there was certainly French involvement, but not necessarily from truly French territories at the time, if that's clear.
All right. Well, again, questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in that's for folks here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. So how is it that she came to be captured by the Burgundians?
She was, first of all, she was kept in a kind of semi-formal captivity in March of 1430 at one of the king's counselors' castles. And she was getting very, very impatient, and she started a letter-writing campaign of her own to various cities that had been reconquered through her help by the king. And she said, if the king doesn't come to your aid, I will. She wrote to the Duke of Burgundy. She wrote letters a lot, and then she just decided to leave. And so she started going off on her own, and that could possibly even be seen as treason at that point. But the king still needed her. He couldn't quite get rid of her at this point, even though he had tried, I believe he had tried to a little bit earlier by ennobling her family and I think, hoping she would just go home once he was trying to push for peace by this point. Joan wanted war, and she was determined to keep taking the battle to the English and to the Burgundians until they were kicked back to their own territories. And so finally, when Philip the Good of Burgundy started making incursions into the towns that Charles had taken earlier, trying to regain them, Joan decided to go back to the fight. And once a truce was up, this gets kind of technical from a military standpoint, Charles's armies were once again engaged with the Burgundians. And it was at one of those battles at Compiègne where it looked like they might be able to face the English. But then Joan was separated from the rest of her party, and she stayed out just as the drawbridge was being taken up to the city. So she was captured by the Burgundians at that point. And the Duke of Burgundy did not immediately sell her to the English. There was a delay of about 5 months.
This would have been at a time when if one side captured a person of prominence from the other, that person would have been held for ransom.
Right.
And that part of the problem here, I suppose, was that there was maybe nobody other than the English maybe who was prepared to pay the Burgundians for Joan. And I think that many people have faulted Charles, now Charles VII, for doing almost nothing, maybe in fact doing nothing to try to help her.
Well, I think one of the very interesting things is her brothers had fought alongside her in the different battles, though they're rarely mentioned. And at one point during this battle at Compiègne, her brother was also captured, and he was ransomed. I think the reason that Joan wasn't even, there was no attempt to get a ransom for Joan. They wanted her in custody. And it's my contention that the English were never, ever going to let her get away, even if Charles had tried, and I don't think he was going to. The English by this point were very, very afraid of her, and you can just read it if you go through the Duke of Bedford's letters. He talks, after her death, he wrote, everything changed when a certain girl, they called the maid, showed up on the scene, and he talked about the desertions from the English army, that they couldn't get recruits to come over from London, that he was having trouble raising money in England for the French war, and he had lost a good deal of property in France, thanks to her victories, if you want to call it her victories. By the same token, the French king, he had what he wanted by this point. He wanted to pursue peace with Burgundy so that he could reunify his dynastic part of the kingdom. He didn't need Joan anymore, yet he couldn't really kill her. So I think it was in his best interest, actually, to do nothing. I think some of her comrades might have liked to help her. And there's a few little notes in some of the accounting records that suggest there might have been some effort, but not a very strong one, to get her back.
Yeah. And again, what's interesting is that then after she was tried and executed, then the king and his circle decided that her rehabilitation was to their interest.
Yeah, that happened 25 years later in 1456. Everything started in 1450. One of the churchmen who was close to the king suggested that it would be a good idea to reopen this case. Normandy had been retaken in 1449, and the rest of France, or the rest of the territories held by England except for Calais, would be retaken by 1453. So that's a very key time where the Hundred Years' War is coming to an end or has ended. And so some of the churchmen felt that it was inappropriate for Charles to have been crowned by a heretic or someone who was executed as a heretic. So they urged him to do something about it, to have a political trial to overturn the original trial based on inconsistencies and irregularities in the procedures. But Charles was very hesitant about doing that, both in 1450 and 1452. I think the idea of letting sleeping dogs lie was very appealing to him because some of his subjects were very recently conquered, and many of them would have been involved in the trial in some way, and so he gave an amnesty. But Charles did not show himself any too willing to go forward with this. It was different churchmen who actually pushed him to reopen this trial.
We are into about our last 10 minutes in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Larissa Juliet Taylor. She's professor of history at Colby College, and she's the author of a new book, The Virgin Warrior, The Life and Death of Joan of Arc. And it's published by the Yale University Press. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. I'm jumping around here, but I do want to go back and talk some more about the trial. Mm-hmm. We talked earlier about the fact that while this was a church court, and that she was being tried for heresy, that this was very much a political trial, this was all really done really at the behest of the English, by the English. What exactly was it that she was charged with having done?
Actually nothing, at least in the beginning, and that was one of the most serious irregularities of the trial. Canon law said that you had to present charges to someone accused, and they didn't. They simply took her into the room the first day of the trial, and they said, swear an oath that you'll tell us the truth. And she said she wouldn't. And so much of that day and the next were consumed with the idea of whether or not she would swear to tell an oath. And she said, no, she can't. And she said she would not compromise the king and various other things. And that's one of the instances in which she said she would lie, because there was a saying among little children that people get hanged for telling the truth. So at least three or four times she mentioned that during the trial. But no charges were formally presented to her. And this was definitely an irregularity, even if it was happening more and more toward this period of time. But she should have been told what she was being accused of. So they let her words themselves incriminate her. And then around March, the trial began in January, around March a canon lawyer had been called into Rouen. And when he arrived, he was talking with various people who had been called as expert witnesses to the trial. And he basically announced that this trial is worth nothing at all. It's completely invalid. And many of the others who had been at the trial rather unwillingly said that they had been threatened. They'd been accused of various things, some of even helping her. And they were told they'd be exiled or drowned in the Seine or thrown into prison or deported to England. So it was a situation of hostility and threats and a trial where no charges had been formally presented. So the next day, they decided basically they had to do something. They had to formally get some charges together, present them to the University of Paris, and then present them to Joan. So it went from one stage of a trial to then the formal stage that led to her condemnation. But the serious irregularity at the beginning let her incriminate herself.
Assuming that the transcript of the trial that we have is accurate and we know who said what could you say about the way that she conducted herself at the trial?
Amazing. And again, this is where I think if you put it all together, that's where the picture becomes more interesting. Because if you just took what the French had said about her in terms of her battlefield skills or her ability to conduct herself on a horse, you would say she was amazing. But here we have a trial record that was signed by the very strongly controlled English bishop. He was French, but French-speaking, but he was in the pay of the English. She managed to turn their words around them, redirect their questions. She would answer a question with a question. She threatened the bishop on several occasions that her soul was in better shape than his and he better watch out. She feigned sickness and illness on a few occasions, and she just talked circles around them. It's stunning to read, even through the layers of translation and some editing that went on, until I think the very end. I think she was being worn down, because there were morning and afternoon sessions, and she'd have questions shouted at her from all sides, and yet she managed to correct them at the end of each day. She was supposed to be shown the trial transcript, and the trial notary later said she corrected things and he remembered she did it very well. So she was astonishing in even her verbal abilities. And some said she spoke like the most wise of doctors.
So no doubt, though, that her conviction would have been a foregone conclusion.
Yes, it absolutely was. Again, the Duke of Bedford had made clear to the bishop that if he didn't convict her, she was just going straight back into English custody.
What can you say about her execution?
It was gruesome, certainly it was very, very gruesome. But she was taken in the morning. She was very, very strangely, she was allowed to confess and receive communion the morning of her execution. And in the Catholic tradition, communion is the body and blood of Christ. So this is a very irregular thing that was done. And so that after that happened, she was put in a cortege and wound through the streets of Rouen, and she was taken to the marketplace in Old Rouen. And there they had built a very large platform so that about 800 spectators, according to some of the estimates, could see this. And this was unusual. Normally you were just tied to a post, and the executioner would knock you out. But everyone on the English and their French collaborative side wanted to make sure that all of the people of Rouen and all of the people who were interested throughout Europe and beyond in this case knew that she was dead. And so they built this large platform, and most people have described it as burning alive. It probably was not, even with the platform underneath. It was probably by smoke inhalation, though it would still have been very, very nasty.
She is a saint in the Roman Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen until 1920. Why, I wonder, did it take such a long time?
There were very, very few people at the time who said that she was saint-like. One or two, if you look at the 1456 record, said in retrospect that she seemed like a saint, or one, I believe the executioner even said, "I've burned a saint this day." But for the most part, most people saw her as a military person. As a girl, yes, but as someone who had won victories on the battlefield, who was aggressive and bold and belligerent, they didn't describe her mostly, except the villagers who knew her in childhood, as pious. And she was pious, certainly, but not, again, the kind of things that were expected of a medieval female saint, which usually was mortifying your flesh and doing rather bad things to yourself, fasting excessively. So I think what happened is politics may have been involved at the end of the 19th century. The Franco-Prussian War was over, though that actually delayed the proceedings. But I think the church probably wanted something from the French, and they went through this procedure of what's called a promoter and a devil's advocate. And in fact, there was a strong case that was made against her sainthood by the other side, and that was normal for whenever someone was canonized. But if you go through those records, you can actually read that most people, or at least the person putting forward that case, was saying she did not die as a martyr, as some suggested, because she died for politics. She had recanted briefly the week before she was put to death, and typically a saint would not, even threatened with the fire. So I think it was politics then, much more than a recognition suddenly after almost 500 years, that she was a saint. And even if you look at her miracles, they were kind of little miracles.
What could you say about her significance to the people of France today?
From what my students have told me, I mean, I've been to most of these places in France, and they don't talk about her that much. In fact, Doremy is kind of hard to find. I got lost trying to get there once. But one of my students told me that when he talked to other college students his age, they all just thought of her as, oh, some strange, bloodthirsty girl. Yet at the same time, she still appears on cheese, brie and camembert cheese. She's the figure for that. And certainly in the 19th century, for nationalistic reasons, that's when she became really important to the French, and during the World Wars as well. She was a figure in school books teaching children patriotism and nationalism. But today I think she's largely been not forgotten, certainly, but she doesn't mean as much, perhaps because of the church aspect of things, perhaps because there's no kingdom anymore. Mm-hmm.
And I was interested, in the book you talk about the fact that perhaps, and you are a medieval historian, so this would have been something that would have been a natural interest, I think, for you, mm-hmm. that you really, in part, got interested after having seen the film that you mentioned,
right.
The one that was made for television where Lili Sobieski played Joan.
Yes.
So you know, some people maybe, if they think Joan of Arc, they think of her. If you're a little bit older, maybe you will know the film in which Ingrid Bergman
right. yes.
Stars as Joan of Arc. But she's a very sort of telegenic cinema figure. And as you said, in your acknowledgement, that probably a lot of people, all they know about her, what they know about her is what they've seen on celluloid or on television. Why it is you think that she seems for dramatists to be such a compelling figure?
Joan, You mean Joan rather than Lely?
I mean, Lely's, I'm sure she's a fine actress. I'm talking about Joan.
It's a fascinating story. It's something that defies, I think, even the modern mind. I mean, how did this, three different categories she defied. She was a peasant, she was of the wrong gender, and she was of the wrong class of society. Mm-hmm. And to have done what she did, both for the French side and then for the in her trial, when that's shown, where she was able to marshal all of her skills, which she shouldn't have even had, probably, to do such a remarkable job and then come to such a gruesome ending, and then being used for all of these different causes over the centuries. I think when people realize that there's just a ton of material out there that fleshes her out even more, that you can start to get to know her that way. But she's just a marvel. I mean, a 17-year-old girl, my students are all older than Joan was when she went to the battlefield. And that takes them aback a little when they start to realize that. And so she may not be the most important figure in history, but to me she really is one of the most amazing and fascinating.
Yeah. So do you have a sense now, having done this study and pored over all of the available information that there is and written this book, that do you have a sense that you know, as much as one can, know her and have some feeling of who she was as a person and not just as a semi-mythological figure?
Right. Yes, I do. I think finally I came to that conclusion during the process of editing and re-editing and everything to do with the book. My editor pushed me to really make clear what I thought. And as I was doing that, I was thinking, yeah, that makes sense. And granted, I'm working from some negative evidence. I'm working partially from periods of times that are unaccounted for, where it would have been best to keep things secret. And yet I think that kind of evidence can be compelling. And then trying to use as properly as I could all of these different sources from different sides. Even the Pope from 30 years after her execution wrote about her in 10 pages of his commentaries in 1461. He called her that astonishing and marvelous maid. And he wasn't quite sure that it wasn't some trick on the French part, but he did say things like, the English turned their backs at the sight of her. They were so terrified. And so that people of her time were as captivated and enthralled or as afraid of her. And it's just an amazing story that I think I have a handle on. And I think that conviction of youth and her own innate skills, her ability to do whatever she did very well, very quickly, can account for a lot of it. But it almost defies reason.
And does it help you, does understanding her, do you think, help you understand the Middle Ages any better?
Perhaps. I think I understand what was going on in France better. But again, there certainly were female warriors before Joan, though they had started to tail off around the end of the 13th century, and they were not that common. But you had women fighting up to that point. But I think that you could have someone from the peasant class. That's probably what it tells me the most about medieval history in general, that it wasn't necessarily all doom and gloom, that someone could emerge from the peasantry or be even fairly well off unless you happened to live in a border region, as Joan did. And somehow end up either doing fairly well for yourself or even in this very unusual case, being an actor on a grand political stage.
Well, there we'll have to leave it. It's a good story, and if folks want to read it, look for the book. It's titled The Virgin Warrior, The Life and Death of Joan of Arc, published by the Yale University Press, by our guest, Larissa Julia Taylor. She's professor of history at Colby College. That's in Maine. And thanks very much for talking
with us. Thank you, David. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Many of our past shows, along with local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. Soybeans showing a lot of strength, although they are off the highs that they made earlier today as traders are eyeing warm and dry weather forecasts as well as an improving investor sentiment in general, as China did something today with its interest rate to spark the marketplace. And as we look at the market right now, we'll go out to that soybean pit. And in the composite trade, that is the pit and electronic combined, July beans are at 14.15, up 28 and three quarters. They have been as high today as 4.19. August, 13.92 and three quarters, up 26 and a half. September, 13.57, up 28 and a quarter. November, 13.29 and three quarters, up 30 and a half. January, 13.29 and a quarter, up 28 and a half. And March of 13 at 13.07 and a quarter, up 26 and a half. In the products, July soybean meals, 424.10, up 9.50. August,